This is Eper 97.0 from Astoria. This is Sinan. Today we are going to talk about identity in general and subtopics of identity. There are some friends of mine who are Erasmus students in Budapest. We will be discussing the issue of identity together. Before starting the discussion, I'd like to give some definitions of identity from three different sources. One is a dictionary, Oxford. The other one is a collective dictionary, let's say, Wikipedia. And the last one is a thick description rather than a definition from Henry Jenkins. In Oxford Dictionary, the definition of identity is very simple. It's a dictionary, the fact of being who or what a person or a thing is, they say. In Wikipedia, which is a collective and refined definition, they say that in psychology and sociology, identity is a person's conception, an expression of their individuality or group affiliations. Jenkins' description on identity is more likely to be how a person would do their identity. He says that as a very basic starting point, identity is the human capacity, which is rooted in language, to know who is who and hence what's what. This involves knowing who we are, knowing who others are, them knowing who we are, us knowing who they think we are, and so on. A multidimensional classification or mapping of the human world and our places in it, as individuals and as members of collectivities. He says that it's a process, which we call identification, not a thing. It is not something that one can have or not. It is something that one does. And here a question rises after Jenkins' description. If it's something that we do, how do you do it? What are the components of your identity? How do you define your unique self? Any volunteers to start the discussion?
I suppose from Ireland's point of view, our identity is rooted in history. History that still sort of continues to this day. Our culture is very important to us, our music, our sports, and it all sort of stems back to our pride in our own culture coming from the days when we didn't have our own independence, and for the last 100 years, or just under 100 years, we have had our independence and we've continued that culture. We still have the music, we still have the sport, and it's still as popular as ever, and we remain, every Irish person remains extremely proud of that, I think.
And that's very interesting, because I'm from Germany, and also the history, of course, influences identity or my identity, but in a totally different way, because I've never been taught to be proud of my like nation or of being German or something. So I would also not consider to being German like something really, really important to my identity. It's just, okay, I'm German. And that's it. I'm not like, wow, great nation in Europe.
Well, I also think Irishness is probably more relevant and culturally relevant to expats or immigrants or immigrants. So people that would have moved to America and England would have clung on to their heritage more than people that still live in Ireland, because they have to express themselves in some sort of way to fit into a subculture. So possibly the world would perceive as being Irish could be American Irish in a sense, because they have more of a connection with their culture than possibly Irish people themselves have, I think.
Identity is, we can divide identity into two main points, sub-points, which we can call, one is personal and the other one is collective. We talked about the starting from Ireland, an individual's point of view, individual's evaluation of identity, but how would you define yourself? How would you put them in order for yourselves?
Like in order
of importance.
If I put the collective identity before my personal, or the other way around?
We all have a collective identity and a personal identity. We just start with the personal now, and then we will move to collective.
I think the most important factor in the personal identity is the family, because it's the first influence you get after your birth. And so there begins your personal history, and yeah, that's the most important factor. Yeah.
That would be a huge part of an Irish culture as well, the family. And traditionally, going back years, Irish families were always quite large. There would have been a lot of brothers and sisters, and a lot of people always coming to their home. So I suppose that's where it would have stemmed from, originally a large kind of family. So that would be...
Identify yourself with a place, a community as well. You could start from, it could be your own street that's community-based, and then you go a little bigger than that, and our own counties are very important to us because of our sport as well, because... So you identify yourself. You could be with a street which could have only 50 people on it, then with a village that could have 1,000, and then you could have 3 or 4 identities depending on what's most relevant in any conversation that you're having.
It's quite tribal.
Yeah. You always have various identities, so not like I behave differently with my parents than with my friends. And
oh, of course, yeah.
So sports play a role in Irish identity?
Yeah, hugely, yeah. One sport in particular, and Michael will be the best man to talk to about this one.
Well, it stems from our culture. Hurling and Gaelic football are truly unique Irish sports. They're played by expats around the world, but it's a uniquely Irish sport, an amateur sport, but played by players that take it so seriously that it's almost professional, and it's all officially about 130 years old, but the sport itself has been played for hundreds of years, but it still continues on to this day. And like James said, it's a very tribal sport. Counties play against another county, and there's no transfer system between, so where you're born is where you're from, and that sort of inspires a lot of pride in your own home place, and I think that's certainly a good thing in Irish culture.
Indeed.
There was a distinction in between Irish and German examples. You both said that history, of course, plays a huge role in personal identity and in shaping it. But while Irish people are claiming that being proud of their history and their country is also crucial, German friend said that it's not playing such a big role. What do you think this is connected with?
We were probably persecuted, and he might have been the persecutors for a few years, so that's probably what it stems from.
we suffered at the hands of the
British
English
crown.
For 800 years. They raped and pillaged our country, and it took us, we're still, you know, there's still obviously a minor civil war going on in our own country in the north of Ireland. It's still active. You know, it took us a long time to get through those 800 years. People are still hurting from it. I think that we're proud of ourselves because we've come through that, and that we're there no matter what adversity comes to Ireland or what happens in our country. We get through it.
I think amidst all that, like when we were persecuted as a nation, just certain things you can cling on to, like music, a sport, which liberates people and makes them feel a certain identity where they mightn't be able to express it under the thumb of a more powerful nation. So that's why people felt liberated to be, and more now, people are prouder now to be Irish, where maybe 50, 60 years ago, even people living in the UK, it would have been kind of a shameful thing to say, oh, I'm Irish. So I think now we're progressing well.
We mentioned the personal identity and collective identity as the two subgroups of the general title identity. When it comes to collective identity, of course, there are, again, subtopics of collective identity, and national and ethnic identity is one of them. Last month, in the Easter holidays, I was with my friends going to Transylvania, hitchhiking in Transylvania. It was so much fun and so cool to see it.
Did you meet Dracula?
I met the relatives. And while hitchhiking, there's a town called Csíkszereda in Hungarian and Mirkurecuk in Romanian. We were going to a Hungarian village which is in the mountains. There were some cliffs that was recommended by our radio lecturer from Elte. And we wanted to see it a lot over there, and started hitchhiking outside the town to go to this mountain village. An old couple took us to their car, and they were both Hungarian. The husband could speak English and German, and I was with a German friend of mine. The lady didn't speak any language. With my kicsit, Magyar, we tried to communicate a little bit. And I wanted to talk to communicate with this person because he could also speak English. It was easy to communicate. I wanted to ask him some specific questions about the Hungarian-Romanian conflict in Romania, particularly. And he said, of course there are problems. I have Romanian friends as well. But our friendship is up to a point, he said. I see it as a I don't know if it's the right word to pick, but a trauma after the Trianon, that Hungary got smaller to its one-third and some Hungarian communities had to stay in other countries. My intention to tell this story was to compare the situation with Ireland. Do you think this trauma also led you to think, like, to be more grasping about your own culture? Or
I think if Ireland had been a free country for the last almost millennium, it's hard to say whether we'd still have that same pride or tradition in our own home place. It probably stems from the fact that it was deprived from us for so long that we held on to it, and that's why it's still probably so strong today. On the matter of language, language is very important to us, but it's sort of a disappointment from my point of view and the point of view of many that Irish is not as common as it should be in the lives of Irish people. It's we're taught it through our primary school education and secondary school education, but very few people can actually speak it fluently, probably because of the education system. But after learning it for 14, 15 years, it's a disappointment that you can't speak the language fluently. It's even saying it there now, it sounds ridiculous.
It's funny as well. It's interesting to point out that our relationship with Britain was still fairly decent, even though they occupied the country due to emigration and the close proximity of the country. The governments mightn't have agreed on policies or the particular armies or whatever might they describe, but I think there was always still a sort of a good relationship between British people and Irish people.
And there still is now.
And possibly due to immigration and the close proximity to the place, and the general public probably would generally get on.
Yeah.
Are there any other cultures or other political cultures that you know?
Yes, I'm French. I have the same kind of history in France, in the region called Alsace, because it was when the first World War began, this region began German. And then at the end of the war, this region began French again. And then at the beginning of the Second War, it began German again, and French again at the end of the Second War. So these people in Alsace, I have some people from my family, some old people, because it was a kind of a long time ago. So I think it's old people that lived this really fully. I think these people were really like not knowing clearly what is identity. Because I really think that language, as it was said before, is clearly a part of identity. And when because in Alsace, some people speak a kind of German, which is not German; it's Alsacian, and it's like French people can't understand it. And but these people don't want to be called as Germans. They want to be French, and this is now the most nationalist part of France. And it's kind of funny, because nationalist in France means like something close to extremist policy, and these people were close to extremist policies before during the Second World War with the Nazis and everything. And so I found it a bit paradoxal that this identity led them to be such nationalist people. So I think identity can be a question of geographic localizations as well.
Surely geography plays a crucial role on it. Are there any other examples from other geographies? We had Irish and French example, German and Spanish examples are the ones that we can also have.
Yeah, as I said, like I don't like feel the same way of where I come from, like the Irish people, for example. I'm not proud of being German. I'm just German. It's fine for me, and it's like a more or less clear cultural identity for me. But yeah, in school we were told that we were the bad guys during the last couple of years in Europe, and this is totally true. And it's a good thing that in Germany many, many people are working on the history, and many people are digging up stories which were not be told until now. And I think it's a really good thing, because, I mean, we have to learn about it, and we have to learn from the past. And so for me, always, like, nationalism is something I'm really, really suspicious about. Because I don't feel the same thing. The only, like, moment Germans can be proud of being German is when there's a football championship. So in June and July, we'll be again very, very optimistic about being German, but then it's over again.
Good chance to win the World Cup.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I'm from Spain, and I think everyone knows that we have a lot of national identities inside of Spain. For example, in Catalonia, there's a huge problem because they don't want to be, not all of them, but there's a part of the population that doesn't want to be Spanish. So they are having like really huge troubles because our constitution doesn't let them to make a sort of official question, like, do you want to be Spanish or not? And they want to do that. And the actual president, Artur Mas, wants to make that question to the population. So I think that's the huge example we have in Spain, but also like in the País Vasco or Galicia, they have different national identities mixed with Spanish common identity.
I see. In the previous example of Germany, you said that at school Germans are told to be the bad guys. Do you remember how your history classes were, your history textbooks at school, in elementary school perhaps, or high school?
It's not only in history classes, like in more or less every subject in school, you learn something about the Nazi time, and always, everywhere. And at some point during the 8th grade, I was like, again, but it's a good thing to have like an overload of information about this. And of course, it's just written down like it's like the truth. Like, we killed a lot of Jews, and it's not a good thing that we did that. So it's not like, I think it's more or less historically correct, I guess. It's not like something is left out or something. So there are like, I think that we are quite honest about our past.
In Turkish schools, let's say, in high school, elementary school, the textbooks we have always kind of exaggerate the Ottoman history, how welcoming they were, even though when they conquer a place, a region, how understanding and considerate they were for the people over there, how they helped them keep their own culture and identity, and how they let them live their religion. When it comes to the foundation of the Turkish Republic, it's also a heroic example of founding a new republic. There is one, there's an epic novel of Hungarians that all the kids have to read when they are in elementary school, maybe. It's called Egri Csillagok, The Stars of Eger. Do you know the town, Eger? Just like some north of Budapest. It's a book written about the Hungarian-Ottoman wars and the Ottoman occupation in today's Hungary in the 16th century. I started reading this book, couldn't finish it yet, and there's a movie of the book as well. I'm going to watch it and then go to Eger to see it in its place. In this book, all Hungarians are very nice, very patriotic, heroic, beautiful, and smart. And all the Turkish are, on the contrary, malignant, dangerous, ugly, and dumb. And the story is like history of all countries almost, maybe. We have these epic novels. And also the discourse of the textbooks, especially history textbooks that we have at schools, they are usually also patriotic. For instance, in Turkey case, probably in Hungarian case as well, it exaggerates our existence and our being and how good we are.
Slightly empathise with that in Ireland. They're not through textbooks and stuff, but through the word of mouth. And for example, I was talking to an American person, and they would have perceived every Irish freedom fighter as a noble kind of a noble man, where the reality is a lot of people were involved in divisive and kind of backward, sneaky things, and they weren't always the upstanding freedom fighter that they were perceived as. At times they're probably worse than the persecutor, but the fact that we were the smaller nation and we had a huge immigrant population living in America, there was a huge support from the media and from certain high figures in America. For example, John F. Kennedy was American-Irish, so he didn't support him per se, but he kind of, you know, he sympathised and empathised. So if you look at it that way, like, you can't. It's not black and white. They were persecuted, fair enough. A lot of people were persecuted, but at the same time, the people being persecuted their own people at the same time for being persecuted, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting topic, the sort of the emigrant status of a lot of people. I think it seems to have become something cool to sort of express your Irishness. And I mean, it stems from JFK, because he actually had a tangible link to Ireland, but it's gotten to the stage now where Barack Obama, during his last presidential visit, he came to Ireland because he had a cousin that was a ninth cousin So he's going back like 9 or 10 generations, but he was there drinking his Guinness and playing hurling, and it seems. I mean, they're doing that for a reason. I mean, there is a specific reason why Barack Obama is coming to Ireland, and it's because I think that Ireland seems to have become a very cool identity to cling on to, and you see it even here in Budapest. There's 5-6 Irish pubs here, and I'm not sure how many Irish people actually run them or how many Irish people actually work behind the bar in them, but these places are obviously very busy and people go in there every night, and it seems it's become a very cool thing, I think, to have.
Yeah, you'll hear it in my documentary later on.
Did you have any compulsory reading at school when you were a kid?
Just in Asquelia, in our native tongue language, which is Asquelia in Irish. Ta cúpla fucum, a cúpla fucula gum. And we'll in a language a good.
Ta changa. Well, Neil may. No,
and that's probably we were made to read and kind of learn Irish at a young age, but unfortunately the way it was taught, it wasn't very we weren't very receptive to it. It was more kind of grammar based. So
when it comes to history in schools, in primary school, you were taught legends of Irish, sort of like people like Cú Chulainn and these great heroes of Ireland. And then in secondary school, you moved on to actual modern history, which is where most Irish history is. But by the time you got to that age where you were 14 or 15, you already knew, not from school, but it was sort of bred into you from your own family, the importance of your own heritage. And that's how you learned a lot of your history, was not in school, but actually at home.
I think that's a fair point. I think in Ireland, from a young age, you know what you are. And where you come from, like from a very young age, you already have a clear understanding of your background and your history. From maybe 6, 7, 8 years of age, you know, basically.
Compulsory reading, that's probably a weird thing in Germany, because I was thinking right now if we had something, and I mean some poems or so, but they're not that famous, I guess. But actually we have like great writers like Goethe and Schiller, and I've only read one piece of Schiller during school, and that's it. The rest I've read from them was voluntarily on my own, and I don't know how it was for you, but it's not like nothing important. I don't know. I don't get it right now, to be honest.
Any other examples from France or Spain?
Well, from France, I think our culture is really present in our education. Like our historic culture is really linked to the arts, for example, because we learn that Louis XIV made Molière play his famous place, and made some famous painters paint for him, and etc. etc. So I think culture from Renaissance till now is really present in our culture. I'm thinking about it because I studied literature at school, at my high school, and I think we almost studied only French writers. I think there are lots of, but I was thinking about it when I was speaking with other students, like Erasmus students coming from other countries, and they told me like they knew the French writers, but they knew also others, and I was like, I have missed something. I think our culture is known as something which has like a kind of importance, but I think we learned a few lines of Shakespeare, or we didn't know anything about African literature, for example. I don't know. So I think we have something like we're really proud of our culture, and I think our culture is something really big, because we had lots of writers, lots of painters, lots of blah blah blah, every kind of art or every kind of expression you can have, we have in France. But I think we are too proud of it, and maybe we should learn to listen to the other countries' culture.
In Spain, for example, the education depends on the comunidad autónoma. So I'm from the Comunidad Valenciana, so I speak Valenciano, and I also know Valencian writers or poets. So I will say it depends a lot where you live, because if you live in a community that have another language and another culture, you have both sides of the culture, and if you don't, so you just have one side and you don't speak the other language, so it's quite hard to explain. But I think the people who live in communities with two languages and almost two cultures, they are proud of that, because you have more background and more history, just in a way of saying the things. But
can we also say about Spain that different communities, you mentioned that different communities have different education systems?
Yeah.
Can we say totally. each community has also, you also mentioned that they have different languages. Can we say that they have different identities in every community? People have different...
I would say that, because a language, even if you don't want, it gives you a different identity. So I would say we have both identities, but it depends on your family or on your own background. If you choose to be like more Spanish or more from your community, but I also think that you can be both at the same time. It's not necessary for you to choose one. So I don't know if I answered your question or not.
So far, we defined identity and went through its subtopics like personal identity, and we started digging the cultural and national and ethnic identities. But there is one more that also play a crucial role, has been playing a crucial role in shaping identities throughout the history, which is religious identity. That's a tricky topic to talk about, because some people, in some cultures, it's not very easy to talk about the religion. For instance, in Istanbul, I was hosting some couch surfers. They were American, and in Turkey, you simply ask where the person comes from, what kind of religion do they have, and then start digging into their culture and their subculture by asking open questions. You just feel comfortable asking these questions. And when we asked, I saw that she felt offended because it was religion and something that you don't touch. And I said, it's very comfortable here. We can talk about it. We can talk about deeply, because we won't judge you. I had a chance in the southeast of Turkey, where there are the Arabic and Kurdish communities living. There is a Christian sect over there, Syrianis. We can call them Assyrians in English, but the word is had its evolution, and still not very clear what we call them in English, because they were a small sect throughout the history as well. There are Orthodox Syrianis, there are Catholic Syrianis. And right now in Turkey, there are around 20,000 Syrianis living. And in this southeast ancient town called Mardin, I was hitchhiking towards more east and stayed only one day, one night in Mardin. But I wanted to talk to some Assyrians a lot. I wanted to learn more about them. So while hitchhiking, just by chance, two a car stopped me. It stopped in front of me, and there were two young guys in it. I asked, "Where are you going?" They asked, "Where are you going?" I said, "To Midyat." They said, "Okay, we are going to Midyat as well. Come over." So I got into the car, and we started talking. And the first question I asked is where they were from, what they do. And I was so happy to find out that they were both Suryanis. One was 19, one was 21. So fast ages, so they were answering my questions very fast as well. Just before meeting them, I visited this monastery in Mardin, and Deirul Zafaran it is called. It has been there for maybe 2,000 years, just after Christ. They built this monastery, and since that day, they've been they've been giving religious education over there. Assyrians are an old Christian tradition, and these kids were very conservative about their culture and their religious identity. I could say that this was one of the main topics that they were experiencing in life, because they were so few and they needed to keep up with their culture and identity so badly that they needed to make it survive so that the next generations will get the information from them and continue to survive with their identity. Are there any examples that you know similar to this? How do people in your countries feel about their religious identity? Are they so much connected to not to lose their identity? Are there any other political cultures, religious cultures that you know that they are trying to keep?
It's fairly black and white in Ireland. Ireland is
traditionally Catholic country
that was always at war with England, which was a Protestant Protestant kingdom, and that continues to this day. We're still a Catholic country, but I think religion is playing less and less of a role in our lives over the last 20 years.
It's funny, religion gets mixed up with politics. So you might be a Catholic and not believe in the religion, but politically you're a Catholic, for example, so you're on one side. And it's important to point out that Ireland was under the thumb of the Catholic Church, because it was traditionally going back here as a kind of a pagan country. So it was, the church had a lot of called the shots, basically, had a lot to say. So there was a fear of religion, I think, more than a belief. That's my opinion. People might disagree with me. People more, I think, believe out of fear than genuine belief, maybe. What do you think, Derek?
I think that, you know, the Catholic Church in Ireland had such a controlling force that, going back from my grandmother's telling me years ago, back in the 30s and 40s, that if a family had a handicapped child and the priest was coming to the house, the handicapped child would be put into a back room and hidden away to save embarrassment. That was the mentality of people's, like, everything was for the church. People were broke in the country. They had no money, but they would give everything to the church no matter what it took. Recent history of the Catholic Church in Ireland has shown that there was a lot of sexual abuse within the Catholic Church. It's been well recognised, even in Rome now. And it's brought quite amount of shame to the Catholic Church, not just in Ireland, but across the world. I think James and Michael both said it plays less and less of a role now in our culture. There is still the believers, but I don't think anybody...
There's still a pressure to believe, I think, coming from older generations. And I think there's still there's a real hesitation amongst younger people around our age to actually come out and say, "Oh, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in the Catholic Church," because it's been bred into you from...
People are still... you have a communion, a confirmation.
Yeah.
Like a Jewish child would have a bar mitzvah at 12, 13, whatever age they're. An Irish or a Catholic person would have a communion. And regardless whether they believe or not, it's more of a celebration of progressing into adolescence. So, like, even every small little thing, whether you realise it or not, still is some way linked to the Catholic Church in Ireland. Like a wedding, a funeral, everything is still kind of done through it. So there isn't, like, there has been decline in numbers in people that practice religion in Ireland, but there's it's still inherent and it's still connected to pretty much daily life in Ireland.
I think 50 years ago people would have identified themselves as a proud Irish Catholic. Now it's just you're a proud Irishman. That's just the way it is.
It's a very difficult question, I think, in Germany, because I, for example, grew up in a very religious family. Like, my grandmother was really, really religious and also Catholic family. Like, for example, every Friday we never ate meat, so because it's just like a rule in Catholic Church. So up to that point, when I started to study, I was believing that, like, whole Germany would be Catholic because I was growing up in a very Catholic environment. And then I've learned, oh, no, there are a lot more Protestants in Germany, but never mind. But I think, like, among young people, for example, my sister, she left the church because there were some scandals, like the abuse of children and also, like, how they treat their workers in Catholic churches. Really, really, really shitty in Germany. And I have a lot of friends who say, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in anything, so they just don't care. There are a lot of them. So I think there's really the number of people who believe is decreasing, and it's really funny because if you're in university, everybody's stating, like, if you're talking about religious, well, I don't believe in God, but blah, 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 and they start every sentence like this, and I'm always, like, really confused by this because I think, who cares if you believe in God or not? So, yeah, this is more or less the tendency in Germany. Though I also have a friend who's going, like, getting married in August, and he's really, really religious, and I think he's following every rule, which is why he is marrying so early. But one thing you really can notice in Germany, and I'm really sorry for that, is that we are very suspicious about Islam, because there are, like, only if you watch the news, there are only news about Islamic terrorists and so on, and bombings and blah, blah, blah. And so people are like, if they see some woman who is covered by the veil, they are really like, oh, my God, she might be a bomber, too, or something like this. So this is a really not so good debate right now in Germany.
Thank you. Well, in France, we have. I thought that religion had less and less importance since these two last years, because we have a new government, as everyone knows, maybe, with a socialist government. And one of the first laws that was. That was made, and it was about a homosexual wedding. And here, at the moment the law was elected, all the Catholic people that were, like, sleeping or just not being so involved in their religious activities came out, and, like, I shouldn't say came out because it's the contrary. But, I mean, these Catholic people began to walk in the streets. Some said, I never did this before, but I must walk in the street because it's not normal that some people love the same sex, the people of the same sex, and all the things. And I think Catholic religion in France is taking more and more importance in the reactionary debate. Like, I think I don't think I have Catholic friends that don't like homosexual people. I'm not saying that all the Catholic in France are reactionary, but I mean there's a kind of extremism coming from this part of the population, which was forgotten before this law. And I think this law made this come to the surface of reality, and it's It was really surprising for me, who was thinking that psychoanalysts replaced the priests. It's a kind of joke in France. We say this because I think there are more and more people who see psychoanalysis instead of going to the church. And finally, I was maybe wrong.
There's one last question that I would like to ask. In the France example, there was the new law about same-sex marriage that came up from the government, and it raised the questions of the conservatives and a governmental move actually gave rise to an identity to show themselves off. From the Irish perspective, we heard that there is a pressure for belief. They pressure you for believing, James said. And from Germany example, we heard that there is in the media coverage, there is bad propaganda about Islam, let's say. And these are the forces that mostly shape our lives. Foucault has a word about it, and he says that who we are or who we perceive ourselves to be is far from a matter of individual choice. On the contrary, it is the product of powerful and subtle forms of governmentality that are characteristic of modern liberal democracies. Do you agree with that? Do you think that we don't particularly pick our identity, but some forces tell us to gain them?
Definitely the case in Ireland, I think. And for example, we don't really have a choice. You're kind of born into a religion more than you pick. Like I was christened. And I was 6 months old. I think we get christened that, so you can't speak, you can't walk. You're you know, the water gets slabbed over your head, and you're a Catholic or you're a Protestant, whatever religion. And you don't choose that, your parents do, and they don't choose their religion. So, you pretty much don't have a choice from the start. Of course, you can diverse. But nowadays, it might be easier to diverse. But in a few years back, it would have been a difficult venture to make. Do you know what I mean, kid?
I think you always have the choice to, like, leave your roots and your... of course, there are forces who influence us, and there's a lot of stuff happening in childhood which you always will carry through your whole life with you, but still I think you can work on yourself and work for yourself and figure out who you are and what you want in life. And if you see, okay, like, the belief in God is nothing for me and it gives me nothing or so, so you can decide, like my sister, just to leave the church and say... Okay.
Well, I think it's interesting, in Ireland, like, to be Catholic, you're not necessarily attached to the religion. It's more of the kind of identity. Because there was such a conflict between Catholics and Protestants, it's easier to identify as one or the other. So you can mix amongst your own more comfortably. So it's less to do with religion and more to do with place and identity. Like I'd venture to say, a lot of Catholic people in Ireland wouldn't necessarily practice Catholicism, but they would identify themselves as Catholic Irish people.
Maybe in France we have more the choice to express our rebellion against or not to tell our rebellion, but just to say that we don't agree with something. I was talking with a friend of mine who is not French and who I met here in Budapest, and who told me, "You are really lucky." I was surprised of what she said. She said, "You are really lucky, you French people, because you have the right and the freedom to say what you think. And to express when you don't want something, or when you don't like something, or when you're against something, you have the right and the freedom to simply tell it." And it's something that maybe belongs to the the French. I'm not sure, but I think.
It's a great song as well, French National Anthem.
Thank you for this beautiful discussion. Thanks to Hendrik in the technical desk. This is EPER 97.0 from Astoria. Thanks for listening.